You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Stand, Season 1, Episode 2, Pocket Savior, is over. But we are just getting started here on post-show recaps. My name is Jessica Leese, and I hate it, but I love it, but I'm so confused. I came into this thinking I was going to hate every second of it. I was going to have a lot to complain about it. And then, Rob Cesternino, you stepped in and you said, we got to keep doing this. And the people spoke and they said, yes, Rob is correct. You have to keep doing this. And now, Rob, guess what? I kind of loved it.
Yes. Let's get in the sewer. Let's go.
Let's dive in. The opinions will be coming out of my mouth like rats.
Oh, so gross.
So gross.
We are here. We're back. We came back.
And, you know, at first I thought, we'll just throw it out there, see if it sticks. And boy, did it ever stick. And I put it out on Twitter. I said, we had fun. We'll do another one maybe at the end of the season if you guys like. And the people spoke with a resounding, hell yes, you're not only going to do a second one, you're going to do it every week. And yeah. I got more feedback on this than I have for every other post-show recap show I've done this year combined.
Yes, we asked for it. We didn't take it as a given that we were going to come back.
No.
And you responded and we're here. And this is how this works in a society.
That's right. The people speak and you listen to the people and you find the way to give the people what they want. And here we are, Rob.
We had no choice.
Back by popular demand, it is episode 2 of The Stand.
Yes. And Jess, I also have to say something else. I watched this last night, recording this on a Sunday, watched this last night, and I was way into it. I loved it. I'm in. I think I came around on this.
You know what, Rob? I kind of did as well. In fact, when you texted me on Thursday morning, you said, guess what? There's a new episode of The Stand dropping. And the feeling I got in my head was like, I thought it was going to be, oh God, here we go again. It was not. It was, oh my God, I can't wait to watch this. And I have two things I got to watch when they drop on Thursday. And this was the one I went to first. And I was like, who even am I? I thought this was going to be terrible. This week's was legitimately good. And there's a lot of things that I can't wait to get into with you. But before we get started, I wanted to take a moment to thank our sponsors, and those are our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
As the Stand could tell us, lots of things could go wrong, okay? Make sure you're covered.
No matter what happens, if you got guys chasing you down the street with guns and $1 million in a suitcase, you want to make sure that somebody's covering you for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm really just impressed. Like, the first episode was like, wait, what are they doing? This is so weird. Why do they do it this way? But I was really struck by in the second outing of this, which was actually very long. It was over an hour of this, but I didn't mind it. This is really well done.
Yeah, the thing is, Rob, it's really well cast for the most part. And individual scenes, and I'm sure we're going to get into it. The individual scenes are really like straight out of the book, and where the book screws them up, they are improved drastically. I just felt like every time there was a new scene, I was like, oh, I remember this. This is that thing from I can't wait to see what they do with this. And there's so much care taken. And if you take it piece for piece, it's pretty great. And as we are going to find out at the end of this podcast, stay tuned, listeners. I went out into the world and I found somebody who has limited experience with the Stephen King universe at large and no experience with Stan in particular. And he has started watching the program. And I went to him to see, just for science, to see if it really is playing as badly to somebody who doesn't know what's going on as it was to us in the first episode. And spoiler alert, it kind of isn't. He had a couple of questions that I was able to clear up that I think even someone who has read the book but hasn't been there in a while might not have remembered. But I think it's playing better than I thought on first blush. And this episode I thought was about 10 times better than the first one.
Jess, I also went back and I've watched most of the 1994 miniseries to also match up with where we are in this series. And I have to say that, especially comparing to like in the 1994 miniseries, in my mind was like untouchable. But just comparing the two works, that I think the 2020 version might actually be superior.
Well, this is a good week to talk about those comparisons, Rob, because I think talking about Larry Underwood, the Larry that they have cast for this and what they are doing with his story is a giant improvement over
superior Larry Underwood.
Yeah, he is definitely the better Larry. In the 1994 miniseries, he is played by Adam Stork, who has basically one other credit to his name. He was Julia Roberts' boyfriend in Mystic Pizza, which... talk about things I have not seen in 20 years. That is one of them. And he just sort of plays it as like, I have a cool leather jacket and I'm a rocker. And that's all he ever does with the role. And this was just like, it was a tour de force on like 2020. Larry is incredible, but he also has a lot more to work with.
Yeah, the 94 Larry is sort of like a pseudo Bruce Springsteen. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And he's
kind of like what they're going for.
Yeah, and he doesn't feel damaged. Like, I mean, Bruce Springsteen also never felt damaged in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the point of this character is to kind of say, like, you know, fame destroys you from within, and it's a terrible thing that is going to ruin your life, because his life is basically on the cusp of getting ruined when the world ends, and then he finds redemption. But you never got the sense that 1994 Larry was in any way ruined.
Yeah. He owed money to somebody.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that was going on with him, but it wasn't really a major plot point.
Right. And again, it's one of those things, 94 Stan really doesn't drive home anything devastating to anybody.
Yeah.
Like, one of the takeaways about 94 Stan is when everybody in the world dies, look at all the stuff that's up for grabs. This is one of the lessons. And the other one is, well, if you owe somebody money and then they die of the plague, you don't have to pay them that money anymore. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Larry in this iteration of The Stand is played by Giovanna Depo, who has a lot more credits to his name. He was in the new adaptation of The Watchmen. If we're going to be rebooting things that needed a reboot, there's one of them. And he is in the series Sorry for Your Loss. He had a role on The Leftovers, which I know that's one of your jams, Rob. I've never actually watched it. He has a lot more credits to his name, and he really does seem like a more comfortable actor in the role. And I thought they added some things to this role. Like, I want to talk specifically about his identity. Like, he is on the cusp of breaking through. Like, it's one of those things where the 94 miniseries, his song was about to be the song of the summer. And this one, it's like he's more of an indie superstar. I think that speaks more to the state of pop music in 2020, to be sure. But he's also like, he's already let fame ruin him, and he's addicted to drugs, and he sleeps around, and he was living with his dealer. This was interesting. Like, don't room with your dealer, right?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the dealer also came up with Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?
Yeah, this is not in the book, and it's not in the 94 miniseries. I thought this was a weird addition, Rob, because it takes away Larry's gift, which in the book and the 94 series is kind of his one redeeming quality, is that he's a very talented musician and he was about to be the next Bruce Springsteen. And here it's like, oh, well, he doesn't even really have that to go on. And I'm curious what you think of this. Like, do you think this is a good addition to the character, or do you think it ultimately doesn't matter?
So for me, it didn't really matter. Like, I don't know necessarily like the songwriting chops of if that was ever a big factor in terms of Larry Underwood, the musician, that he sounded like he was like about to play the acoustic guitar. And I wondered, maybe is he like a talented musician? Does he have a good voice? feel like that most, singers, I'm sure, are not writing all of their own songs. So the songwriting chops didn't bum me out too much.
Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense.
But I would have liked to have heard him sing Larry Underwood.
This is the interesting thing, Rob. What if we never hear that song ever?
Yeah. Because in 1994, Jess, that it's a little bit like Game of Thrones, that there's exactly one song in the Stand universe that people know the words to, which is the Larry Underwood, Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? But we didn't even hear it once.
Yeah, well, this was the thing that always kind of frustrated me. It's like, so after the entire world dies, we just forget that pop music was ever a thing? Because I kind of feel like if I'm making the trek west to Boulder, I'm going to be wanting to have something in my Walkman while I'm on my way over there. I'm not going to forget that, like, the Beatles ever existed. So it was interesting that, like, all of a sudden nobody can play any music anymore. Like, the last time anybody listens to music, it's like Harold and Franny in Maine, and they leave that all behind. It's like, nope, no more music. That was the last time anybody ever played pop music. And
yeah.
And then it was like, oh, well, we only remember one song. It was like that song that was the hit of the summer, but I don't remember who sings it. It's like, no, somebody out there, if that song was that ubiquitous, it would be like if somebody rocks up to Boulder and is like, hi, my name's Katy Perry. And they're like, huh, that name's kind of familiar. And like everybody's walking around like, California girls, undeniable. And then someone comes up and says, my name is Katy Perry.
Colorado girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, huh. Nobody's going to put two and two together. No, that's absolutely going to happen. So it was always a weird thing to me. So I like the idea that maybe we don't ever get to hear what this song is.
Mm-hmm. So you like this better, that Larry Underwood is not as big of a deal, so that people aren't like asking him to perform constantly.
Right. I
do
like
cameos.
Yeah, I like that he doesn't even, that maybe he doesn't even have to tell anybody. After he told Rita this episode what he was doing, and like it was kind of his goodbye to all of that. I like that a little bit better. And there's also the fact that, I mean, your mileage may vary on this, Rob. The version of Baby, Can You Dig Your Man that they recorded for the 1994 Stand, it sucked.
It was overproduced.
It was like Phil Spector, AOR. It was very, very bad. I'm like, there's no way in any universe, even in 1994, that this would be all over the radio. This is not even going to be all over the radio in 1974. It was bad. And I think maybe there is some concern that no matter what song you have to embody Baby, Can You Dig Your Man, it's not going to be very good.
Yep. Hard to make a fake song that is a hit song.
Right. And I think everybody runs into that. Like every time somebody in literature tries to say, like, this person is a beautiful poet and, you know, they're a literary genius, and then they try to write some poetry that this person would have written, it's like, well, you're not a poetic genius. You didn't, you know, whatever you come up with is not going to be as good. So I think that's something they're running into. And also, like, the lyrics that Stephen King comes up with are not great either.
Yep. Noted songwriter Stephen King.
You know, he does perform in the Rock Bottom Remainders, but yeah, I don't know how much of that oeuvre he writes. So there is, yeah, there is that. But
yeah,
I'm really impressed with Larry the character so far, and the way that, also, New York City is an interesting place to have this particular part of it set, because, you know, statistically, there's going to be quite a few people left over in New York City, even if 99% of the population dies. So there's going to be some interesting, you're going to run into people right away. Whereas if you're in a tiny town in Maine and it's like you and your creepy neighbor, that's it. That's all you're getting. But New York City, there's going to be people around.
Yeah. There were a few colorful characters that we met in the episode.
Yeah. We got to talk about a hospital gown guy.
Yeah. The Yankee Yanker, they called him.
Yes, indeed. It's a clever name. But I'm sure, Rob, as a Mets fan, you can relate to the desire to defile Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, well, I was wondering, that guy was, well, I guess he was a Yankee fan because he wanted to run around the bases naked. But and then on his second request, I was a little bit like, you know, that if you were going to deface Yankee Stadium like that, like, do you love the Yankees? I do not want to do that to Citi Field. I feel like that would be very insulting.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if he considered it an act of love. And I feel like if I was Larry, I would have had a lot of follow-up questions.
Yeah, yeah. No, that guy was so great in Central Park that this is a very edgy show, I would say, like, especially like compared to the, you know, 1990, it's 1994. We're on broadcast network. And so here in a lot of ways that this is a much more edgy show. That guy who comes up to and starts talking to him about what he wants to do at Yankee Stadium. And then there's just such a great beat, no pun intended. There's such a great moment in that conversation between him and Larry, where he tells Larry what he's going to go do. And then after he says it, he just says, "Oh, what's that look?" I was dying. I was so funny.
There's a lot of places where you notice the ability to do things on streaming that you couldn't on network TV, and like the shot from behind of that guy, so you can see his bare butt behind the hospital gown. That kind of underlines how he's not all there. And you know, so you get to swear, which I think is key in a universe where everybody else is dead.
Yeah,
and you also. The gore factor is up quite a bit.
Yeah. Not to mention there was also sexy time in this episode also.
Oh, yeah. It's some decent sexy time. Like they were beautiful people having a beautiful time. And
there was a lot going on.
There was a lot going on. It was quite a lot. And the gore factor, I think, is really key because I realized in the 94 miniseries, like every corpse you see is mummified. And finally, it hit me that the reason that every corpse was mummified is because they couldn't get away with the kind of maggoty, like rats crawling out of bodies.
Yeah.
Snot all over your face situation that we were getting here. And I think maybe it's poorer for it.
Can I ask you the sort of like the whole like a neck gill effect that's on in the 2020 stand? Was that in the book? Is that a new creation? That seems a little overboard with the special effects.
Yes, I have that in my notes. That is, in fact, in the book. And they chose not to do it, I guess, because it's a practical effect that takes a little bit of doing. They chose not to do it in the 94 version. It was just like people kind of looked sad and then died. Yeah, it was the sign that you were about to die was your neck inflated. And then a lot of times, like you'd see the corpse would have like black marks on the neck after the neck deflated.
Oh, everybody looks like they're Eddie Murphy out of like Meet the Clump.
Yep. Like they probably, when Eddie Murphy got Captain Trips, they probably didn't realize anything was wrong with him at first.
Like, oh, is this, or are you filming a remake of Meet the Clumps?
Yeah, are you doing a bit?
Nutty Professor 2? Yeah.
Is this snotty clump? Like, what's with that mucus on your face?
Yeah.
It's a much nastier way to die, which I think is better than in 94 when it was just like people just sort of fell over dead. And it's like, oh, good, that person's dead. I can have their wallet. Where here it is like, yeah, these people are obviously in a lot of pain and it's no good. I think one of my favorite moments this episode to that point was when Larry has had a one night stand and he's getting up and like trying to do his Irish goodbye. And the woman he's with sits up and she's like, "I don't feel so well. Can you get me a tissue?" And he's like, "Nah, gotta go." And she looks up and she's got like snot all over her face. It's so gross and awful and also pretty funny. I don't know what the network standards are about snot, but I imagine that that would have been frowned upon by ABC.
Mm-hmm. Probably. But, you know, so it's working for me. I've turned around.
Yeah, I've turned around as well. Something came up when I was talking to David Bloomberg, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because I wonder if you are in a world where there is a pandemic going on.
Yeah.
We posited that they might have reordered the story a bit because they didn't want to bombard us with pandemic right up front. But is it better to have to confront the end of the world at the top of every episode for 5 or 6 episodes than it would be to just like get everybody's reaction to it in one episode?
So just to go back to like the creative choices, like I think that this was already decided that they were doing it this way prior to, you know, March 2020. So I don't think this was a pandemic related response. I think that this is, you know, it's interesting. I think it would be maybe you might lose more people, like with a first episode that was all about how, you know, oh, the world is getting infected with a virus, and be like, all right, seen this one before.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like the first episode of the 94 miniseries, and you have obviously seen it a little bit more recently than I have.
Yeah,
I feel like that first episode was just like vignettes of people confronting the virus, and somebody in their life gets the virus and dies. It's like Franny's father and Larry's mother and like everyone in Stu's town. And then in between that, they all have the corn dream. And here we have not seen very much corn dream at all. I think that's interesting, too, because you don't necessarily get the sense yet that that's what's bringing everybody together.
No, I mean, you do see everybody together. You know, we sort of like have, you know, cut flash forward to life in Colorado where everybody has made it there so far. So we sort of get that. It's interesting that I feel like what the show has done is like we're able to get sort of like the beginning of the story and then their arrival in Colorado, but we've sort of yada yada the journey. And like, I kind of feel like that I'm coming around to being okay with that, because I feel like that most of the really good stuff that I remember is happens like in the beginning or later on. And I feel like that a lot of the meat of the story doesn't really happen on the road once people sort of like make their initial like journey to Nebraska/Colorado.
Yeah, right. Once they make the journey to take off, there's just a lot of nothing between here and there. Like,
yeah.
You can't even like stop to look at Mount Rushmore or anything.
We yada yada the road tripping.
Right. And part of the reason I realized also why they're yada yada the road tripping
Captain
is because,
tripping. Yeah.
Yes, I have a bold prediction for how the next few episodes are going to go. I think in the first episode, we kind of were introduced to an antagonist and a protagonist.
Yeah.
And then this episode, we also got antagonist, protagonist. I think Mother Abigail specifically says, yeah, I've picked five people to run things. I think at least the first four episodes, we're going to meet one each of these people. And the reason that we can't do it linearly is because we are mostly introduced to the next people when other people run into them. And so I would imagine next week we're going to get Nick or we're going to get Glenn. And so I think it's going to be like the Nick/Ray combination, like Nick meets Tom Cullen and then they meet Ray, who's probably going to get her character fleshed out a lot because, let's be real, Ralph kind of sucks. You know, if you're not covering the road trip linearly, then you can go back to that road trip and find the point on the road where you meet Glenn Bateman and have Glenn be your last character to bring people into the world. And then you have your kind of your core five. You have, I would imagine, the five have to be Stu and Ray and Glenn and Larry and then Nick.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we know Nick doesn't get to go to Vegas and everybody else gets to go to Vegas. So I would guess that each one of these episodes is going to be kind of meeting somebody, although we don't ever get to know as many of the flag people as we do the Boulder people. But I would guess that that's how they're going to structure it. Or next week we get like a little bit more of Stu and Fran, and then like they bring in Glenn, and then we start to see like something happening on the Vegas side. So
yeah,
it's a good way to if you're going to do it out of sequence, it, as a way of bringing in one new person every episode, I think that's not a bad choice.
The thing that I was really struck by when I was watching 94's version again is just how much things are yada yada in terms of like the character story. And I really wonder like how much I actually got from the story from sort of like fusing like the 94 miniseries. And then I read the novel and then I feel like, okay, that there was a lot more of like the character beats that were from the novel, obviously. And I feel like that the 2020 version has a much better opportunity to be able to sort of flesh a lot of these things out by way of like focus on one character at a time. And then also just in terms of like the runtime on this, that the total of runtime, and it's on YouTube, you can go check out the 94 miniseries. The runtime total is 6 hours, where this is going to be 9 hours total on CBS All Access. So it's going to be, you know, 50% longer than the 94 version was.
And I was excited about that because Lord knows there's enough in there to bring in elements from the novel or even to go in a totally different direction. And also to bring in a lot of stuff. And one thing that they brought in this episode, which they completely left out of the miniseries, and I think we should go now and talk about Rita, who is the character played by Heather Graham, and who does not appear at all in the 94 miniseries because they kind of decided to just sort of combine the elements of her character with Nadine, who we sort of met this episode, but really not very much at all. And Rita is somebody, when you read about her character in the novel, Stephen King does not write women very sensitively most of the time. And you got this like seething contempt for her, like just kind of leapt off the page. And here they have done something very different with her that I think is a vast improvement on what we got in the book. And also, I think this is an important character to put into the miniseries because it can change the tone of who Nadine is.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting to talk about this just in terms of, you know, in going back to the 1994 miniseries. So in that, so the Rita character and Nadine are fused into one. But also when Larry shows up in Boulder in 94, he's actually with a different woman.
Yep.
Lucy, is that her name?
Yeah, Lucy.
And so have they fused here Nadine and Lucy, because Lucy is the one that has the kid with her in 94.
Right.
But here Larry shows up with the kid and with Nadine.
Well, no, I believe Lucy is going to show up in the 2020 miniseries. I'm trying to check on that now, but there's so many people in this. That
because she was sort of like the caretaker to the kid, and you know, that was like how we get introduced to her.
Right. She is actually, there is no credited actor for Lucy here. But the way that the series is structured, we might have just written Lucy out, and I think that's fine because I think the interesting choice, and this is the choice that they take from straight from the book, is that to have Nadine be the caretaker of Joe makes her a much more interesting character with a lot more sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you kind of got the sense like that 94 miniseries Nadine was kind of a loner and basically, yeah, like a sexy Pee Wee Herman. That's exactly what she was. But that she was just kind of adrift and that she needed to anchor herself to a man. And it just so happened that the man she was destined to anchor herself to is Flag, but she wants to be with Larry. And there's also Harold in there. And it's sort of this love quadrangle that she finds herself in. And everything she does is in relation to which man she is going to have sex with. And I like this better. I don't like that we don't know anything about Nadine yet. We don't know how important she is, except that she's an actor that you've heard of.
Yes. Okay. She is here in 2020. She is played by the actress Amber Heard. So it will not be a stretch for her to play a woman in a dysfunctional relationship.
That is true. She has a number of credits. To her name. I think most famously, you know her from Friday Night Lights, would we say is her?
I think you say defendant in various Johnny Depp lawsuits.
Well, that too. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think mostly we know Amber Heard for what she does off screen rather than what she does on screen. Known mostly for having been with Johnny Depp. And so you know that you're like, oh, well, she must be more important. Although, on the other hand, you see Heather Graham and you're like, oh, she must be important, but she's gone after this episode. It's a one-off.
She's dealt with Captain Trips and Captain Jack Sparrow.
Yikes. I don't know who I'd rather deal with in this day and age.
Yeah. Captain Trips might be slightly less problematic.
Yeah, you would guess. Johnny Depp is not an easy personality to deal with, for sure.
No.
And when it comes to Nadine, we've got a lot more to talk about. But before we do that, let's take a moment and hear from our sponsors.
Do you think we'll get a separate Nadine flashback episode? Because that really we got nothing about her in this second hour.
100% I do. And I think she's going to be one of the people, like, as we're bringing in a new person, we're getting their flashbacks and their present day. I think that's what we get with one of these characters, either like as the flip side with the story that we're getting from Nick, or the one from either Ray or Glenn. We will get Nadine as the other half of that. The same way we got Lloyd this week, we'll get Nadine as one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the choice to make her a teacher who rescues a young boy and kind of brings him back. And this is something that happens in the book where it's kind of the boy starts to come out of it, and where he never really comes out of it in the miniseries. And that was also kind of weird. He starts to come back to himself, and then he's just sort of like, Larry has this new woman, Lucy, in his life. And so he just calls him Nadine Mom and Lucy Mom, and kind of ping pongs back between mm-hmm. them before Nadine pieces out because she's got to go be with Flag. And I like the Nadine we're getting so far. She seems to have a lot more agency, and it seems like her choice is going to really be a choice. And it's not going to mm-hmm. be, she's not just a pawn anymore. And she's a real character who does some good things and some bad things, where Stephen King and also Mick Garris never knew what to do with Nadine, except that she needed to eventually go be with Flag.
The 1994 Nadine is played by Laura San Giacomo, and she has a hideous wig
yes.
that is changing throughout the series, where her hair color is changing. I don't know how it held up in 1994, but looking back at this, it's so bad.
Yeah.
It's really like a Halloween store wig that they keep switching out on her.
You know, the 94 stand is full of bad wigs, and that might be the worst of them. And she also, mm-hmm. like, she always has this slightly pained look on her face, like it's itching her and she can't scratch her head, is sort of the mm-hmm. the energy that she brings to the role. Like, she's just sort of, mm-hmm. she sort of has internal turmoil, and we never really get why that is or what it's about. Whereas I think we're already getting more from the 2 full minutes of Amber Heard that we've seen.
Yeah. Can we talk about Heather Graham here in this episode?
Yes. In fact, I think we should. We took a little detour on our journey to Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
So Heather Graham plays Rita Blakemore, who appears to be this sort of sheltered woman who married into money. She has a very nice apartment, and mm-hmm. she's very well dressed and has kind of kept herself up very nicely. And she meets Larry, and she's excited to find somebody who seems like a nice person. And they decide to throw their lot in together, except that she really doesn't want to be there. And I think this is a much better way to approach this. In the book, we need to talk about Rita a little bit. She is she's a socialite who has a lot of money, but is very sheltered and doesn't know anything about the real world. And she complains incessantly, and she's addicted to the same drugs that Larry has in his duffel bag. And she's always like complaining and whining about the trip and demanding more drugs. And then she accidentally overdoses. Mm. And Larry's like, oh, good.
Okay.
That bitch is dead. I can go find another woman who won't complain as much. And it was just like Stephen King clearly hated this character so much that he killed her off because he was tired of writing her. And this character is much more sympathetic. Like, you get the sense that, like, bad things have happened to her, because guess what? In the Stand universe, bad things happen to everybody. Everybody you know is dead. You're going to be sad about that, and it's okay to let everybody have a sad about that.
Just, should we take away that Rita is dead at the end of this episode?
Oh, yeah, I guess we should take that away, because I guess it's not explicit, is it? I'm just assuming that because that is what happened in the book, but I guess we don't know that. We see that she is washing down pills with a lot of alcohol and walking away from Larry, and she's no longer there at the end. So I think we have to assume that's what happened to her. And she didn't.
Yeah.
She didn't necessarily just go back to New York to see if she could catch up with the guy that was screaming about monsters. But she doesn't want to be in that world anymore. And I think that is relatable.
Yeah, because it's stupid.
Yeah, it's a really, like, why would you keep going if everybody else is dead?
Yeah.
It's hard. And I think...
But not for anything. Didn't she just find, like, a nice guy in Larry?
Yeah, she did find a nice guy in Larry. But I don't know if is that going to be enough, necessarily, for a lot of people?
I don't know. You could play it out for a couple more days, see what happens.
I mean, we don't know how long they were gone. Like maybe they mm-hmm. have played it out for a couple more days at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she really doesn't like camping, Rob.
Yeah.
Have you thought of that?
What happened to Mr. Rita was my question when they went back to her place.
I'm assuming the same thing that happened to everybody.
Hmm. Yes. Okay. But then after that, where is the mortal coil formerly known as Mr. Rita?
I would guess they have a lot of money. And if he got the flu very early in the pandemic, somebody was probably there to take care of the body.
Okay.
So you do see that quite a bit. Like you see, like Larry's mother got taken care of. More or less. Like she got to the hospital, there was still a bed for her, and they didn't just tell her, yeah, good luck, go out in the curb and die. They, you know, she had a bed and she was getting some measure of care, although not much at that point. And so I think mm-hmm. you had waves, like you had the first few people dying, they still got to go to the Undertaker and get taken care of. And I would think at any point in New York City, if you have enough money, you can pay someone to take that body out of there. So I'm guessing she didn't ever have to deal with the mortal coil of Mr. Rita. She just kind of called somebody to deal with that because that's what rich people do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be my guess. I do want to talk a little bit about the New York from this because I am a New Yorker. And I am, Rob, here's the one thing. There's one thing that got me on board with this particular program and this particular adaptation. I think this maybe wipes out every sin it has committed so far because I'm so excited about this. In the original novel of The Stand and the miniseries adaptation, there's an iconic scene that is Stephen King frequently describes as the scariest thing he ever wrote in The Stand, and it's the thing that people remember. And in the original miniseries and the novel, Larry escapes Manhattan with his female companion via the Lincoln Tunnel.
Yes.
And he goes through a pitch black tunnel that is reeking to high heaven and full bumper to bumper with cars full of rotting corpses. And he starts to hallucinate and he's worried that one of the corpses is going to come to life. And he's just trying to get through the tunnel and it's claustrophobic and horrifying. And my first thought when I encountered that was, why is he taking the tunnel? This is a terrible idea. There's no reason to do it. And in fact, in the miniseries, there's a line where he and Nadine are standing there and she says, I don't really want to do this. This looks like a really bad idea. And he's like, well, if you want to walk 6 miles up to the George Washington Bridge, be my guest. And she's like, oh, no, I don't really want to do that. Why don't you do that? Just do that. It's fine. So I deeply appreciated that they did that here. There's no reason to go through mm-hmm. a tunnel full of corpses unless there is no George Washington Bridge. And George Washington Bridge is fine. Just go up there and go across the bridge and don't go through the death tunnel. Like, it's just not safe.
Yeah.
I appreciate that the idea, and in fact, it's one of the formative ideas that Stephen King had when he was writing this, was at the end of a pandemic, like the Lincoln Tunnel full of corpses is really horrifying. Yeah, it is. You have better options. Go do that. So, and this is a thing I've been ranting about for 20 years. If I ever met Stephen King, this is the first thing I would bring up with him. So, they have heard me. The makers of this miniseries have heard me.
Did you like the adaptation that they did where instead of having Larry go through the Lincoln Tunnel, that he has to traverse through the New York City sewer system?
Absolutely loved it.
Like,
99% loved it. I think it makes so much more sense. And I think they really sat there and thought about it. They thought, well, we can't put him through the Lincoln Tunnel because that's just a stupid idea. Bring him up to Washington Heights, put him on the GWB. That's perfect. But we still need that scene because it's so creepy and so awful. But how do we get him in a tunnel? And it was just a great idea to put him in the sewer tunnel. I almost think it would have played better if they'd put him in a subway tunnel. But I don't know that. I think there's a lot of unknowns with when you put him in a subway tunnel because there might be a train down there or something and he wouldn't be able to get around it. So I like they put him in the sewer and then you get the claustrophobia and the darkness and the grossness, and then you can hallucinate the dead body with the rats coming out of it. And all of that is just the same visceral gross thing that you got in the Lincoln Tunnel. And then he had a legitimately good reaction to it that I thought already, you know, that you're not dealing with Adam Stork anymore, because when he comes out of there, he is a different person and he is ruined by this experience. So he needs mm-hmm. that experience. This is something Larry, the character, needs. And they found a way to do it without making him make a decision that is completely stupid on its face.
Can we go back to the stockbrokers, which come to harass Larry and Rita on the street?
Yeah, this is a very, I don't think this exact thing is in the novel, but it's a very Stephen King-y.
This is, I thought this was odd.
It was pretty odd. And you get this sort of moment played for laughs in a lot of post-apocalyptic literature, I think. Like Walking Dead had a good scene where somebody found a whole bunch of cash. And it was initially like, oh, wow, a whole bunch of cash. And they're like, wait a second, this doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah.
And I guess I thought one of the things that, you know, you and I had this conversation when we were recapping The Walking Dead a lot about do we think that if everybody except for a handful of people were dead, would everybody band together and make a better world? Or would there just be some bad actors that are just out there to have a good time? And I think we met our bad actors this week.
Yeah. Jess, do you think these guys wear a suit every day? Or do you think that this is just part of like that they have this bag of cash and they thought, OK, it'll be more convincing if we're wearing suits to make this business offer because we're businessmen?
Well, I think the guy that had the suitcase full of cash, he struck me as not wearing his suit terribly well. But I think at least one of the other guys, like that was his thing, and maybe the other two picked it up. But I think there's a moment, and I keep going back to this because it's the most hilarious thing about the 94 miniseries, the tone it takes with regard to, well, everyone else is dead, so you can just have their stuff. And I think that's what these guys are doing. They're like, huh, well, everyone's dead, so I can go wear an Armani suit, and that would be awesome. And I can go take a big suitcase full of cash because nobody's going to miss it. I think there is that phase of apocalypse acceptance where you just kind of run wild and you get to do whatever you want. You can go to Yankee Stadium and defile home plate if you want. And then it sort of sinks in that you have to go, you know, you have to actually find your next step. And that probably doesn't involve staying in the city. But these guys, I think they realize, well, we can go do some crimes and we can wear really cool suits and we can be like a 13-year-old's version of a cool guy. I think these guys should have been younger, to be honest.
Yeah, I just feel like this is like a weird offer also. Like, they have the guns also.
Yeah.
Like why have the starting offer with, okay, we'll give you the $1 million. Like, okay, well, you should have taken the deal because now we have guns.
Yeah, also, that's really heavy. I feel like, why are you carrying that around Manhattan? Doesn't that sort of slow you down? Hide the $1 million someplace and like pull it out when you're ready to make the deal. But you know, what kind of idiot is not going to realize that's not a very good deal in this world? What are you going to spend that on?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think there are going to be guys that sort of feel like they can play Scarface once everybody else is dead. But it felt like nobody's that stupid. Nobody's going to assume everybody thinks that $1 million means anything at this point. Just use the gun. Just if you really just want to enslave the girl, like use the gun and shoot the guy.
Just going back to Larry Underwood in the book, did he have a substance abuse issue in the book that was not in the miniseries and then is back here? Or is this a new character trait?
Yes, he did. Although it was more like, I don't think he had a full blown addiction at that point, because he certainly seems to have a lot of contempt for people that are fully addicted. But he was certainly using a lot of party drugs, and it was sort of like the initial shock of fame had gotten to his head so completely that he owed a lot of money to a drug dealer, and he was definitely had like the, you know, in the green room, there'd be like a big bowl of pills for him to take. And he was certainly enjoying it in the way that you would think a rock star would enjoy drugs. But I don't know if he had fully acknowledged that he was approaching a problem status at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like everybody dying absolved him of having to grapple with addiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
this is a silver lining.
Yeah, I guess it's a silver lining. And it was sort of like, mm-hmm. I think that was part of the point of Larry's character. It was like, he had what people would admire as a successful life prior to everybody dying. But in fact, everybody dying put him on a path to do something much better with his life. And mm-hmm. what he had then was not very good at all. Is, I think, why he is the way he is and why he was written the way he was. That's my, like, ninth grade English interpretation of it, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Jess, do you want to talk about the other side of things with Lloyd?
Yeah, we got to talk about Lloyd here. Again, this is one of these cases of, we're on streaming, we're not on network anymore, so we can make this really, really gross. And get almost a Pulp Fiction scene here with Lloyd and his partner robbing a convenience store, managing to accidentally kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's very gross. It's also interesting to me that you get a much more sympathetic Lloyd here as well. He's obviously, like, dragged along for the ride, doesn't want to kill anybody, and almost looks for a second like he's going to actually save the day.
Yeah, the Lloyd here, it's a younger guy. I feel like it's more of like a early 20-somethings as opposed to the 94 Lloyd, who is a character actor. I feel like he's been in a million things. I think he's probably, late 30s or 40 in the time of the stand from 1994. So I thought this was interesting way to go. I'm not sure if I'm for it or against it, this new Lloyd.
It feels to me to be a little bit closer to the book, but you never got the sense that Lloyd was ever conflicted in the book. You just felt like he was whining that, you know, the guy that died should have gotten the punishment that he ended up getting, and that it was unfair that he was, you know, in prison on a capital murder charge when he... You know, he was not the one that instigated anything, and it was all the other guy's fault. And this time, you feel like he is sorry for what he did, and he could have been nudged either way. And it's the same thing with Nadine. You feel like a nudge in either direction could have made a difference.
Yeah, he's a little bit like, well, oh, why'd I have to go and be there on that day? If I would have just hung out with a different guy that day, things would have been fine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly where he's at with it. And it seems like things happen to him rather than him really having much agency here. And you get a lot more of his starving to death in his prison cell, too, where that was very glossed over. They yada-yadded through that as well in the miniseries. And you get the desperation of him. He actually looks like he's about to die at the point where Flag shows up. Like, Flag really lets him sweat it out for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they must have really spent a lot of time on Lloyd and his life in the cell in the book, because I feel like I remember that much more like viscerally as a thing from opposed to what I saw in the 94 miniseries.
Yeah, they do. And especially in the 1400-page version, there's like 200 solid pages of Lloyd in the cell and like pondering, like at first, like having to come over having to overcome the taboo of the rat, and then. I don't think he actually ever eats his cellmate in the book. I know he doesn't in the miniseries because cannibalism bridged too far.
I don't think he has a cellmate in the 94 series either.
Yeah. No, he does, because the cellmate is dead and he's in there with the dead body, and Flag makes a joke about it, but it's clear that he never actually did it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I like the decision that he has to come to, like to rip open a rat. We got a ripped open rat. That's another gross thing. And then he also went as far as to attempt to eat his cellmate, which I think speaks a lot more to the lengths he's willing to go to preserve himself. Mm-hmm. And that makes him a little more attractive to Flag. And hey, this is our first like real experience exposure to Flag. So I got to know, Rob, what do you think of him?
I mean, I'm in. I like this Flag.
He's very sexy. And even I think Lloyd even says something. He's like, wow, you're a really beautiful man or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like him. I think He doesn't seem as untouchable as I thought he was going to be when Alexander Skarsgård is playing him.
Yes. Jess, was this an homage to the 94 flag that he seemed to be wearing the Canadian tuxedo to visit the jail?
Yeah, I don't believe this is something that Stephen King dwells on a lot in the book. Like, I think the guy is wearing jeans in the book, but the loving homage to the Canadian tuxedo of 94, I think he's wearing the exact same outfit.
Mm-hmm.
For sure, with the little smiley face button, which I think the smiley face button is in the book. It's been a while, but I think that's a detail. But I think I gotta say Alexander Skarsgård rocks Canadian tuxedo very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wants Lloyd to be the right-hand man.
Yeah, which I think you do need when you're trying to build up an evil empire. And maybe Lloyd is like the last active inmate left alive, the last criminal left alive in the after the apocalypse.
Yeah. I also like that they gave to Lloyd's character that a police officer had died in robbing the convenience store, which was not part of 94. I don't know if it's sort of like we could play a game of, is this the novel 94, 2020, all 2 out of 3 or what? But I don't know if this was a thing in the book, but he, as being a cop killer, that, you know, there's like some extra disdain towards him from the police department.
Yeah.
It's, from the jailers. Yeah.
It does seem like that is the case, but it's also the case in the book that he has been on a 3-state murder spree with this guy, Polk, who kills everybody he comes in contact with. And Lloyd is now afraid to say anything to him, like maybe don't kill these people. Where this seems more like this is a guy he just met and they were just going to go rob a convenience store and get some beer money. And then the guy starts killing people and he's shocked. So I think that's a more interesting character as well. And the fact that the cop dies, we even see how the cop dies. I think we see him shoot the cop in the shoulder, but I don't think the cop is necessarily dead at that moment. So it's possible that he doesn't think he actually killed the cop, which puts another wrinkle in it as well. But yeah, and so it's kind of like he got a raw deal at every turn. Like he chose the wrong guy to go with, and then he unfairly takes the blame for killing the cop, and it's killing a cop, so the cops really hate him, and nobody's given this guy a break until Flag gives him a break, and then it's like, now you see why he's so loyal to Flag. But I like it, and I like that there's a little bit of magic in it, and you'll find out when you hear what David Bloomberg and I talked about. David Bloomberg is really anti-magic in these things, and I think he's going to find a lot to hate about this miniseries as he goes along. Because there's a touch of it, but there's a whole lot less of it than there was in the previous one, and I wonder why that is. Like, we're getting... Flag is obviously a magical being who has the sixth sense of where people are, and he can bust people out of jail and commit sleight of hand acts, but there's really a lot less of that than I think it was very liberally sprinkled throughout the original miniseries. And of course, it's the main theme of the book. So do you miss the magic, or are you happy to see a little bit of it now? Or do you think we're going to get more of it?
So I don't say that I miss the magic. I understand that this is a lot of like the battle of like good and evil. And I was thinking about something you said on the last podcast where you were saying that, you know, the one of the themes of the book is like what, you know, has man wrought on the world with having this, you know, that's a theme of the book, you said, where that we see, you know, Flag is holding the door open, where I kind of feel like that, you know, the whole thing is like a battle of magical good versus evil, you know, ultimately. So why not let him be responsible for this all happening? Like, take man off the hook for what goes on.
Yeah, I think that is, that also gives you a bigger window to bring that in, too, because I think there are a lot more religious overtones, I think, in the 94 miniseries and also in the book that I wonder if those play differently to the audience of 2020. Because you don't get quite as much of that. Like, we've seen a little bit of Mother Abigail, and she's obviously a deeply spiritual person. But this also makes me wonder, maybe the different ending that Stephen King is talking about is maybe we don't get a badly CGI'd hand of God destroying Vegas at the last possible second. Like, is there a better ending?
I hope so.
Is that the ending he's talking about? Because I'm going to love that. I'm going to love waiting to see what's going to happen with that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, now I'm excited about it.
Well, that's where you're getting into the danger zone.
Yeah.
So, like, keep, you know, all possibilities are open until we know they're not. But let's not get our hopes up.
Yeah, let's not get too excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I tell you something I was excited about?
Yes, please.
That the end of the episode, after Flag ends up getting Lloyd out of the jail, smash cut to a brand new key.
Yes, and it took me a minute to realize why that was great. And it's funny because he just got a brand new key, but then it's also Heather Graham is in this.
Yes.
And this is her theme song in Boogie Nights. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It was hilarious. It was pretty inspired, actually. Either that or it's like it's too on the nose. But I was excited about that as well.
I think some people didn't like it because it was too on the nose based on some of the reviews that I read. But yeah, I was very excited because that Heather Graham that I said last time where Roller Girl's going to be here. But I feel like it's a little insulting to Heather Graham to like sort of like, you know, that's the role that defined her career. But here, you know, here she is, a special guest star, and then we get the call back to Roller Girl.
Yeah, which I think I think that plays as reverence, to be honest. It's like they're glad that they have her here. It's not just like, well, she'll work for cheap. It was like, we're excited to have Heather Graham doing this.
Good God, that's Heather Graham's music.
Exactly. We're happy she's here, and I think she is kind of an unsung hero. I'm always happy to see her in whatever she's in. I think she does a solid job. I don't know. She overshot her fame potential when she tried to carry a sitcom that was a very bad sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the career moves she's made since then have been fun.
And she is the love interest in the most successful of the Austin Powers films.
That is correct. And not to mention the most successful of the Hangover films.
Hmm. Yeah, I forgot about that.
She's solid. And she looks really good. For Boogie Nights having been 20 years ago, that she is recognizably the same person is pretty remarkable.
Yes, and the Hangover films, if anything, taught us that only bad things happen in Vegas.
Yep, which I think we're about to find out. I can't wait to see what they do with Vegas, to be honest. It was one of the highlights of the miniseries was when Randall Flagg sets up shop in Biff Tannen's Pleasure Palace.
Yeah. So that's going to be very fun to see. I do think that it does put a little bit more of some weight behind the theory. Rita is dead. I think that, you know, now we open episode 3. Heather Graham is still alive. I think it takes away some of the punch of closing the last episode with, you know, I've got a brand new pair of roller skates.
Yeah, I think, and she's not credited for other episodes. So I'm going to guess that we are meant to know that she is dead, but we're not going to, you know, in a world where you can't like call the cops and report somebody missing, like how do you even know? So if she just kind of goes off into the sunset, I think that's a better ending for her than like Larry discovering her body in the tent and being like, oh, wow, I'm glad she's gone, because that's kind of how the book goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you looking forward to in the next episode, Rob? Like, what direction do you think we're going to take next? Who do you think we're going to meet next?
I don't know. I think that we're probably going to go down and meet Nick Andros. I think that that's probably important to get him in there. By the way, in terms of like the stuff that did not hold up great in the 1994 miniseries, the Rob Lowe portrayal of Nick Andros was both bad and the story was boring. So I'm hoping that they can do a little bit there to punch that up.
Yeah, well, I think they might skim over it a little bit more. Like if you can tell Nick out of sequence, you get to the interesting stuff a little bit quicker. His whole thing where he's taking care of the guy in the jail cell, that needed to be a lot quicker, for sure. I think once he meets...
Yeah, it's very boring.
Yeah, once he meets Tom Cullen, things heat up.
Yeah.
But it's funny, because Rob Lowe is like the one thing everybody remembers about 94 Stand.
Yeah.
And yet that performance maybe doesn't hold up so well.
The performance doesn't hold up great, and then also that he, you know, where I feel like that I probably would refer to him as a deaf mute, that he's constantly referred to in the 94 miniseries as deaf and dumb.
Yeah.
That's like a medical term. And like every single person, like, oh, deaf and dumb. Oh, yes, of course. And then also there's a lot of the R word thrown around when we meet Tom Cullen in the 94 story as well.
Yeah, I think both of those portrayals are going to be slightly more sensitive. And I think we discussed last episode that it is a big misstep on the part of the production here to not even consider casting a deaf actor. But I would imagine we're going to get a more sensitive portrayal in that regard. And one thing that I clocked that isn't in any previous iteration of The Stand is when they bring Joe into Boulder and Franny goes and says hi to him. And she says, sometimes they teach autistic kids to sign. And she starts signing to him. She's like, yeah, I had a deaf brother. That's not in anything up to this point. So I wonder if that's being set up so that she can communicate with Nick on a level that other people can't.
That's interesting.
So that's a good detail, because there's also no sign language whatsoever in the miniseries. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because like Rob Lowe doesn't know any. And I think Stephen King takes pains to write this character so that he doesn't have to learn any sign language either. He just says, well, he was bounced around from foster home to foster home and had to learn how to read lips perfectly. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a better portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
I think this actor, as far as I've read, has spent a lot of time like trying to understand what it would be like to be deaf in this world. Yeah, I'm curious. We got to meet him a little bit, like just for a second. I don't even think if you didn't know he was deaf that you would have clocked it. He doesn't say anything, but it's like maybe he's just a quiet dude.
Yeah. Just last week, we were talking about the reveal of that Franny is pregnant with Stu's baby. And like, boy, that was a little jarring. Are people going to be able to get that? But going back to 94 miniseries, that they didn't do such a great job with that either. I mean, that you don't even know that Stu and Franny were together to the point where then she says she's having dreams. He says, do you want a sleeping pill? And she's like, well, no, I don't think it'll be good for the baby. And then they just start kissing.
Yeah, this is something. Also, David Bloomberg was completely thrown off by this as well. I don't think that's Stu's baby in either miniseries, even though they don't explain this. But in the book, it's definitely not.
Oh.
And I don't remember in the 94 miniseries if that's the only time it ever comes up. But in the book, she has just broken up with this guy she's dating because he's an idiot. And she's like, oh, wait, I'm pregnant. I definitely don't want that guy in my life because he sucks. And she's about to tell her parents, oh, yeah, I can't go back to school in the fall because I'm pregnant and I've just ruined my life. And then everybody dies. And so then at the end of the miniseries, when she has the baby and they're like, oh, it's got the super flu, it's going to die. And then it doesn't die. And it's like a new hope for the future. That resonates more because it's not the product of a relationship between two immune people.
Okay. Yeah. This is very interesting because I'm doing like the math in my head, you know, when like I'm like, boy, she just met Stu. It's July 15th. How long has she been on the road for? Like, okay. You know, the baby's due in January. I'm trying to figure it all out. But OK, that would make more sense.
Yeah. The math does not add up for it to be Stu's baby. And there's even a confusing moment that David clocks her. He's like, what was it? Harold's baby? There's a moment where they don't hate each other. And like, that's kind of gross, too. Like, that can't be it. But yeah, I believe that baby was conceived pre-plague. And she is just trying to navigate life as a potential single mother in a world where everyone is dead. And that is Franny's story. And then she meets Stu, and Stu's like, I'm totally cool with this being someone else's baby. Let's be a family and yada yada. So
okay,
that is, it is interesting that they haven't really explained that in the miniseries to this point. You just know that she's pregnant at some certain point in the future.
Mm. Also, Alf's dad is the Dr. Fauci-esque character in the 94 miniseries that made me very excited to see that.
I forgot that. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And you saw Ed Harris, of course.
Yes. Ed Harris in the bald cap.
Yep. Which is weird because isn't he normally just bald?
Yes. But is it like it was good.
Yeah.
It was good.
One thing I was very sad that they did not carry over into the 2020 miniseries is you hear a guy screaming about monsters. And I got very hyped for a second. I'm like, are they bringing back Kareem? That really yeah. wanted Kareem to come back, and he didn't.
And yeah.
In fact, you don't even know what happened to the Monster Shouter guy. And I think we are poorer for it. But it's also, in 2020, you don't have those guys running around screaming about the end of the world anymore.
Yeah, they just tweet.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Monster Shouter guy probably just started screaming because he lost his platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love this.
I'm so glad you love it. I kind of low-key do as well. It's in the same place as the original Stan miniseries was, where I kind of knew it wasn't good, but I had a ridiculous amount of love for the things in it that are good.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very excited to continue this journey with you, Rob.
Yeah. I think that the 94 miniseries, like, that was a good introduction point. Then read the novel.
Yep.
Then watch the 2020 miniseries.
Yeah, I think that's the order you want to go in. And I apologize preemptively to everybody out there who just wanted an easy introduction into this world. It's based on a 1,500-page novel. There is no easy introduction. I would say if you can get your hand on the, if you can get your hands on the 800-page novel and you only have time to do one thing to prepare to devour the rest of this miniseries, I would say read the 1980 novel. That gives you all the background and all the characters that you need. It is not full of needless digressions, some of which are incredibly upsetting and unnecessary. And it moves at a faster pace. I think that's an unpopular opinion. I think most people do prefer the longer one, but I think shorter one's a quicker read, obviously. And it's also, it gives you everything you need and few things that you do not need.
Yeah. Okay.
But extra credit, watch the 94 miniseries and read the longer book. And that will get you so deep into this that you'll be like us and you'll see these scenes and be like, that was a really good adaptation of that scene. And I'm on board.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I really have come to appreciate 2020 version. They're taking some big swings here. They're getting up to the plate and, you know, they're swinging for the fences. Is it going to work? I don't know, but I appreciate the ambition.
Yeah, I think you have to appreciate ambition in 2020 because most of us have lost ours.
Yeah, they're going for it. Is it going to work? We'll see.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, they didn't just phone it in.
No, they didn't. It does seem like an earnest adaptation. There's very little that's cynical about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. At least insofar as, you know, the subject matter itself is not cynical because it very much is.
But, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but it seems like they really believed in what they were doing. And a lot of things that they have gotten right, they've gotten extremely right. I didn't even totally hate Whoopi this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was Whoopi even in this episode?
Yeah, she was a little bit because they meet her.
Yeah.
She's in, I guess you kind of mostly hear her off screen, but she is in it briefly. And you get a little bit more of her than you did last week, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited for next week, and I'm really happy that people are excited about this as well.
Yes. Just what is the titular pocket savior that Larry refers to? Is it his stash?
I think it's supposed to be a double entendre. I believe it's a stash, but it's also the name of his album.
Yes, but what is the does Pocket Savior, the album, refer to his stash?
It must. Or either that, or he's got, like, maybe he's got a little plastic Jesus on a keychain or something. But
yeah, Is it a play on, does he like have a lot of like ballpoint pens that are leaky that he doesn't want to ruin his dress shirt? So he has a thing that he uses to protect his pocket.
I'm waiting for somebody to bring those back. They're really a very useful item.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, maybe he had a hole in his pocket and somebody stitched it up and that person is his pocket savior.
Okay. Pocket savior. All right. We'll see what that, if we can maybe figure out exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah. Or maybe we don't want to know.
Maybe we don't want to know.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
But yeah, it hadn't occurred to me that it probably does refer to his stash. But I guess if they even come back to it, because they may not, like they may not even come back to baby, can you dig your man again? I think where we've seen those very Stephen King specific lines, like we even remarked upon it last week when somebody said Captain Trips one time and that was it. This might be another one of those.
Yeah.
But I do know one thing that everybody can dig, and that is the rest of the content over here on Post Show Recaps. We got so much going on, yes. Rob. And we've really built up the brand in the last couple of months, I feel. We have a whole week of content, even though there's not a whole lot of new TV going on. One show that is consistently running. We got two more episodes left of Star Trek Discovery. And so Mike Bloom and I talked about episode 11 this week. It's been a really strong season. I was not so high on this past episode, but we still found a lot to love in it. And we're very happy with the overall direction of the season. We are also embarking on several different rewatches. We just wrapped our coverage of Avatar: The Last Airbender. Zach and Jake just wrapped season one. They are releasing an episode this week in which they talk about all the things that they've learned on this first season watch through, and then they'll be picking up season two. We also have, we're going to have Josh Wigler and Kevin Mahadeo, who are going to be talking about the Wonder Woman franchise on Everything is Super. They'll be talking about original Wonder Woman and new flavor Wonder Woman 84. Josh Wigler also talks to Mike Bloom weekly about Down the Hatch, which is our Lost rewatch. And they're just reaching the end of season three. It's weird how all these seasons just end right at the end of the year. It's fantastic. We also have Mandalorian has just wrapped. We have some wrapping up for that. And then in the new year, there's going to be so much new stuff, Rob. It's an exciting time. Even though we have a dearth of new television, we are talking about a lot of old television movie properties in a new way.
Yeah. We're having a lot of fun.
Yeah, we are having a lot of fun. So what are you up to? I understand you have a podcast.
I do have a podcast talking about a lot of different things when I'm not rewatching 1994 miniseries events in my spare time. Also, Kathy Bates has a radio show.
Yes.
And she's like taking callers and smoking cigarettes. And like the army comes in and just blows her away while she's talking. She's, you know, the truth bombs are just way too intense from Kathy Bates.
I was waiting for that character to come back here and be a podcaster, but I guess that doesn't make a ton of sense. I think there's somebody on like a Twitch stream who says I'm being silenced and that's about it.
Yeah, Harold had a thing where he was like, listening. He's like, well, I'm not going down without a fight. So here, I'm going to blow my brains out right here in front of everybody.
Yeah.
And Harold was just like, shrug.
Yeah. It's like, wow, these podcasts are getting more and more dramatic. Anything for ratings. Yeah.
So, okay. So I feel like I don't feel like that there's been a lot of like people on like the radio talking about like, all right, I'm going to tell you what's really going on. But then actually take like, telling people what was really going on, just not like spreading like conspiracy theories. So I feel like they didn't necessarily nail that part of it. But
no,
I talked about two different ape movies featuring must-see TV staples. We talked about Dunstan Checks In and the film Ed, starring Matt LeBlanc, over on Robin Community Podcast with special guest Lita Brillman over the past week. And then I'll be working very hard on the best of 2020 over on Rob Has a Podcast.
Oh, I'm excited for that because I can think of several moments that are definitely on that list and it's going to be fun to relive them.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. And it's always a big project for me at the end of the year that I always say, why did I say to do this? This was a lot of extra work.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but I think the listeners really appreciate all of that work that you put in for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Well, I'm looking forward to that for sure. And then I want to thank everyone who has come on board recently to be a patron of Post Show Recaps. You should know that when you support Post Show Recaps on patreon.com, your monthly pledge helps us keep things going. And it opens the door for us to bring even more great content. In fact, it was sort of like we have patrons now, so we are free to bring some crazy stuff like bringing Rob back to recap The Stand. It's stuff like that. If you have a passion project in your head, maybe be a patron and maybe throw it in our ears and we might see what we can do with that. But you also get access to special content like 3 extra podcasts a week, weekly newsletter, access to a community of like-minded fans in our Discord channel. And at certain levels, you even get special PSR swag, including a Wiggler's Wombats hat. So if you ever wanted one of those, this is the channel you can go through now. You don't even have to write a song parody. It's a pretty sweet deal. So to learn more about patron perks or to sign up now, visit postshowrecaps.com/patron or patreon.com/postshowrecaps. So if you're already a patron, we want to say thanks again. We really appreciate your support. And we really appreciate Rob stepping across the boundary to come back to Post Show Recaps and talk about all things The Stand with us. Rob, where can people find you if they want to weigh in on our takes?
I'm at Rob Cesternino, and I still want to hear from people if they like this, because there's no guarantee we'll be back next time. Okay.
Oh, so we're gonna end it on a cliffhanger every week.
Don't just take it for granted that there'll be a Stand recap. Okay.
Yeah, I like this better. I was fully prepared to say we're just gonna do every week, but yeah, you know what? If you guys stop listening, we're gonna stop doing it. If you stop appreciating,
maybe we'll be back.
Yeah, maybe. If you stop appreciating us, we're out of here, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fine. Then we'll just talk on the phone.
Yeah. I mean, I can just tweet my takes to Rob, or I can even like slide into his DMs and I'll tell him and you
just
will
DM
never
me.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah.
You all will never know.
That's right.
But seriously, we appreciate all the people that, came to us to tell us that we needed to keep doing this. And we will love to hear more from you about what you agreed with and disagreed with and what else you'd like us to talk about next week. Now, stay tuned for a little check-in with one of our colleagues who is not quite so steeped in the lore of this universe. Earlier today, I had the pleasure of speaking with David Bloomberg, whom you might know from his podcasting work at our sister channel, Rob Has a Podcast. David is the co-host of Why Blank Lost, a podcast that takes a look at the strategic game of every Survivor and now Big Brother contestant to try and figure out what their fatal mistake was, their Randall Flagg foot in the elevator door, if you will. David hasn't read the novel or seen the original miniseries, so we wanted to know if he's finding this adaptation to be the confusing mess that we think he would. All right, so let me get him out here. Here's David Bloomberg. David, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. So I'm really interested. Last week, Rob and I kind of came to the conclusion that this miniseries really wouldn't make any sense whatsoever to somebody who has absolutely no experience with The Stand. So for science, we're bringing you on now to find out if this is in fact true. And I want to thank you again for dropping your free BritBox subscription for a second to jump in on CBS All Access and pick this up. But before we get started talking about The Stand in particular, I'm curious what is your experience with The Stand in particular and the Stephen King universe in general?
Pretty much zero. I have no experience with The Stand. I have not to my recollection read any Stephen King. I have probably seen a few of the movies, but I've never been a huge Stephen King fan.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you're just not a Stephen King guy, right?
Yeah. But I was looking forward to The Stand. It sounded interesting. Maybe you were the one who made it sound interesting, you know, when you were talking about it on Facebook or something, but and also the fact that there's so little other TV out, it's like, ooh, something new.
Yeah, it's true. It's hard to find new TV these days. Do you have any particular affinity for like post-apocalyptic literature in general?
No, really, I don't. I of course, watch everything. I say, of course, but I watch all the Walking Dead stuff. And I don't remember why I started watching it because I'm not a huge zombie fan. I've seen a few movies, but for whatever reason, when that started, it also looked interesting. And I've watched every episode of every series and listened to you guys talk about it.
Man, I'm sorry.
Other than that, No, really. I mean, I guess I've seen a few post-apocalyptic movies over the years, but it's not necessarily a genre I've looked out for in particular.
Okay, well, then you are exactly the person that I want to talk to. So you have seen the first two episodes, and we are putting this interview in our episode two recap. And so I want to know, are you completely at sea, or do you kind of feel like you know what's going on and where it's headed?
I kind of feel like I know what's going on, but I don't know where it's headed. And there are certain things that are rather confusing in terms of more the genre than anything. And what I mean by that is, when I watch science fiction, I want it to be science fiction. I don't want it to be science fiction plus magic. And that's my own personal thing. But this seems to be science fiction plus magic, in that you have the science, you have the disease, you have the virus, and then you have magical dreams. And you have a Flag, who apparently just appears places. And so that part is the part that's a little head scratching to me.
Okay, that's fair. And the nonlinear storytelling, do you always have a sense of when something is happening in the continuity, or does it seem like, are you finding that confusing?
It's a little confusing, but at least they put up things like 5 months earlier and you know, at times. I was usually able to figure out when things were happening. Now, some things are very odd, in like Franny being pregnant enough to show, apparently with, I'm guessing, Stuart's baby, but it was only 5 months since, you know, she and Harold were leaving for Georgia. So the timing on that one is a bit of a head scratcher.
Okay, well, I could explain that one for you if you want. I don't think it's going to be a terrible spoiler, because I think it impacts, like, there's one tiny plot point it impacts. It's not Stu's baby. And it's interesting because they didn't cover that at all in the first episode. And I was kind of surprised, but I guess it's because it was Harold's story and not Franny's. But she is about to tell her family that she is pregnant by this total rando that we never get to meet. And so it's like she's just ruined her life, but it doesn't really matter because the world's ending and everything's different anyway. So
okay,
there you go. And yeah. It seems like somebody had mentioned in a recap, and I don't know if they were just like projecting what they had read in the book, that there's a brief mention of it, but I didn't catch it. And apparently you didn't either.
No, I was actually wondering if you were going to tell me somehow it was Harold's, because there is that one scene in the first episode where she talks about they are the future of humanity.
Ooh.
Yeah. But it was like, I just couldn't see that, you know?
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that's extremely confusing for you?
Like the stuff regarding Flag, I'm presuming it was his foot that held open the lockdown door at the facility that started the whole infection.
That seems to be the assumption that everybody's making. Yeah.
Right. And of course, that makes him somewhat superhuman, you know, considering what his foot did to the door. So, you know, it gets back to that whole situation. Now, I have other scientific related questions, like why aren't we seeing more families? Because you would think immunity would be genetic. And yet it seems only one person per family ever survives.
Yeah, that is a good question. That's not really how immunity works. It is true.
Right.
And it becomes kind of a plot point later on. It's like, oh, well, if your baby is not 100% yours and like not the product of two immune people, can it be immune? And they worry about that a lot through the course of the story. But yeah, it's also evident in some places that Stephen King's not necessarily a scientist.
Yeah, I wondered about it for Franny's baby, although I thought that, you know, at the time I thought it was Stuart, who was the father. But also, there's no one left to spread it anyway. I mean, this thing would have gone through and burned itself out. So I'm not sure that there's any mechanism to continue spreading the virus. I suspect that will be dealt with in later episodes.
Yeah, well, Stephen King says in the book that the virus is airborne. So different from the droplets that we're currently dealing with.
So airborne and can survive for months and months and months airborne, apparently.
I mean, viruses are not alive, but yeah.
Well.
Yeah. It's like he says, he seems to imply that now it's in the air and it's always going to be there, sort of like the Walking Dead zombie mm-hmm. virus. You know, they kill somebody and then it turns out that, well, everybody has it now, so it doesn't matter if you got bit or not.
Right. Right. I guess if you can make up a virus, you can make up any properties of the virus.
I guess so. it's refreshing change from the real virus.
Yes. Yes. Although there are certain things that definitely, as I was watching, you know, it definitely sparks a reaction. Like when Stuart is first in the facility and the nurse comes in and sneezes and says allergies.
Yep.
And you're like, oh, my God, that's, you know, exactly what's been happening here. Now, as it turned out with me, I had a cough. Well, I have a pretty much permanent cough, but I actually had pneumonia just before COVID came to America.
Mm.
Yeah. Just before the Los Angeles gathering for RHAP's 10th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, at the time, COVID was circulating in China. And every time I would cough, someone would look at me and go, COVID? And then they, you know, every one of them thought they were being funny. But after the, you know, 20th or so time, you've heard it. But, you know, so that's the same thing that I felt when she sneezed and when the doctor had a little cough. And it's like, ooh, flashbacks here, you know.
Yeah, it's very funny to me. And Rob and I talked about this a little bit in the first episode, how much now that we've actually had a pandemic, how much is correct and how much seems really off base with regard to how they've handled this on the show?
Yeah, I do wonder if they added in, you know, at the carnival or whatever it is, there's a radio voice that's saying the governor is considering closing down all public gatherings. And I wonder, did you add that in, you know? Because of what's going on. And the other thing I was thinking is it's way too soon. This virus has only been around for like a week at that point. Governors didn't consider that for months, most of them. So,
yeah. And I think some of that is down to like how quickly it spread. But there's almost no talk in any of the previous source material of like, are we going to shut things down and tell people to go inside? It's mostly like the government tries to pretend it doesn't exist at all. And mostly succeeds until everybody is dead, which I found an interesting tactic to take because it's also a pre-internet area. Like the way that the information spreads is very different in the current time than when the book was written in 1979.
Yeah, yeah, I could definitely see that. And there is the one presidential announcement that said there is no truth to the rumor that it is 100% fatal. It's like, oh yeah, it's 99% fatal. Great, you know.
Yeah, and apparently, the voice of the president is a secret cameo, and I didn't know this until much later, and I have to go back and listen to it now. But apparently, that was Bryan Cranston as the president.
Ah, okay. It sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it.
Yeah. But I think that's what they were going for. Like they need the president to be someone that seems, you know, sort of familiar. So you feel like, you know, the president.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's been really, I found it really difficult to watch some of this go down. And especially the way I wonder if the nonlinear storytelling of it all is going to mean that we have to contend with the outbreak of the plague for 9 entire episodes. And I don't know how I feel about that either.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that. Like, are we going to get each episode the story of, okay, here's the story of someone else who's arriving? Because I guess they said Mother Abigail predicted 5 people would be in charge in Boulder, if I got that right.
Yep.
And so we've gotten 2 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Well, at least two. I don't know. Maybe Franny's one of them, too. I'm not sure. But so are we going to get for at least the next three episodes, like the same thing, you know, these three people, their story of getting here?
I'm going to guess so. And there's actually, it's weird because this whole framing device is not in any of the source material. But now that you mention it, I think that's exactly how we're going to do it. We're going to do, there's a possibility that we will combine two of those stories. And they, if the five people are the people that I think they are, then we will get some more of other people's stories as they kind of like interweave as they find each other. So we will get a little bit more of someone's journey as they encounter one of the other people that's supposed to be in their leadership group. That would be my guess, because the actual, the linear version of it is just like a big road trip for the first half of the book.
Well, and the road trip, I mean, while parts of it I didn't find terribly interesting and I felt kind of didn't really go anywhere, especially with Underwood, you know, parts of it, it was like, okay, so Harold and Franny left for Georgia and then poof, they're in Boulder.
Yeah.
And, you know, Underwood said he followed the sign, their signs to get there, which I guess this is another, you know, nitpick or confusion. Okay, he spray painted signs, but in a big city, even in a small town, how do you just happen to come upon that sign?
Yeah, that is a big question, especially because they seem to all want to go to Atlanta. And in, and I don't know how they're going to weave this in, but in the previous miniseries, they go to the place in Vermont where Stu is being kept, and they write it on there, and you assume that everybody's going to go there, and so they would see that sign, and then they say what highways they're taking, so you know where to look for the next sign. And I'm not sure why they all decided they're going to Atlanta first, but maybe that will be explained. It's something I'm in the dark as you are on that.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like I said, there are some confusing parts, no doubt. Like, I mean, I guess at some point, Franny must say, he must, you know, tell Harold about the dream. And, you know, that must be why they decide to go to Boulder. If they get to Atlanta and find that there's nothing there. But you are left guessing a little bit. I guess it's just, I'm like, oh, okay, well, we'll see what happens there. The only other part is these little rocks that Flag is handing out, which I have no idea what those are. I think that falls back into the realm of magic again.
I would think so, too. I don't remember if this is a major plot point in the series. It kind of reminds me of, to go back to Fear the Walking Dead, it reminds me of the keys that Ginny is handing out.
Okay. I mean, it does identify who has had contact with him one way or the other, but it also seems like some people have had dreams from both of them. So, you know, that part is a little bit odd as well. I'll let it ride and see where it goes. I don't necessarily understand his motivations, but I guess it's one of those things we'll see as it goes.
Yeah, you have to, it's hard to, I don't even know if I know what his motivations are, and this is my third go round, but technically my fourth go round with this story, because there's two different versions of the novel and the previous miniseries, and now we're at this. And Flag is just kind of like, oh, is he just chaotic evil? We don't really know. But we'll see what Alexander Skarsgård brings to the character, because it's a very different Flag from the previous Flags we have come to know. But do you like it so far? Do you think you're going to stick with it? Do you want to see how it plays out, or is it too baroque for you?
No, I'm definitely going to stick with it. I'll see. Now, does that mean in a few episodes I won't drop it? Yeah, it's possible. If, you know, for example, they go too far to the side of magic that doesn't make sense and not enough on the side of science and science fiction. Because that is, like I said, that is my own, you know, personal pet peeve, and I fully recognize that everyone agrees with it. But I have dropped series before for that reason, where it's like, oh, I watched this because I thought it was science fiction, and instead you're doing this other thing. No, I'm perfectly happy to watch fantasy and magic. You know, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan, everything else. I just want them to stay in their genres.
Yeah, I'm not sure how this story is going to play, knowing that, David, but I'm going to be very interesting. I might have to drop in, provided you stick with it. I'm going to have to drop in with you again later on in the series to see how it's going for you. And if you rage quit it, I would also like to hear about that.
All right.
All right. But for now, I think we'll leave it there. But thank you so much for dropping in and letting me know how this is playing to a total stand newbie.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Anytime you want my newbie opinions, I'm here for you.
That's great.
I will be your guinea pig.
I deeply appreciate it, David. Thank you very much. So that about wraps it up for us. Thanks again to our guest, David Bloomberg, whom you can find on Twitter at David Bloomberg, in case you want to check in with him and see if he's still on board after a couple more episodes. You can find Rob Sesternino on Twitter at Rob Sesternino, and you can find me at Haymaker Hattie. Again, I want to say thank you to all of our listeners and especially to the patrons of Post Show Recap. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.